Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Hello, 2020.
We got another fantastic edition of the Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show coming your way. We got Sean Wheelock on tonight, who is a play-by-play guy for Bellator. He's also the co-author of a book, Is This Legal?, which is about the creation of the UFC and the ownership of the UFC by Art Davey. And I don't think Art is going to be with us tonight, but just Sean. He is the co-author of the book. Art Davey is the author. Is the other co-author, I should say. And we'll have to ask him all about the book itself, how it's doing, and you know, some of the funny stories from it, of course. I'm sure there's plenty. And we'll also have to pick his brain a little bit about Bellator. There's been some big news this week. We'll talk about it, I'm sure, when Tom gets on the air, about Bellator's decision to let go of Eddie Alvarez early, where his contract expires. And they already shoved him in a UFC fight pretty much immediately after he was released. He got signed by the UFC, and he's going to face Donald Cerrone at UFC 178, I should say. So, very interesting stuff there. We'll talk about that a little later. We had a pretty interesting upset over the weekend. Rook got the upset. Did you see that fight, Tony?
I did. That was, aside from the first fight on the card, not a very entertaining card, I'll tell you that. And, you know, I'm a big-time fight guy, and I'm going to be a boxing apologist fighting the day I die. But at the same time, I am not a, what's the best word? I'm not going to, you know, bullshit anybody. I've talked to people before, and, you know, they're such a fan of something that they won't give you a honest appraisal of it. It's like, you know, you like, say, a steakhouse, you know, Outback Steakhouse. And Outback is the greatest place in the world. Love Outback, love Outback, love Outback. And you got, you just happen to get, basically, you know, the worst part of the cow made. And it's overcooked, and it's bad, and it tastes like shit, and it's chewy. You're going to walk out and say, Outback's the best place ever. Outback's the best place ever. Because you're, you know, almost an apologist for that brand. I'm a boxing guy. That's my card on Saturday night. The first fight was entertaining, this Figueroa fight. You know, I mean, he got caught over his eye, and it was bad. I think they were looking for a way out. They're like, yeah, you're going to stop this fight, you know, go to the scorecard, take an arrow ahead. And the doctor came out and said, no, it's okay to fight. Next thing you know, he walks up there and knocks the guy out. Next round. I'm like, damn, all right, this looks pretty cool. Then you get to the Sakio Bikina Anthony Durrell fight. That was a rematch of a draw from last year. And I remember Durrell was really mad. They didn't even show the fight the night before. And he was furious. You know, with that draw. And I thought he won the fight, the first fight. But he gave up some rounds in there, and he went to a draw, and he went out of the ring. So he came out to try to really make a statement. And he was going to come out, and he was going to win. He was frustrated the first time with DK's dirty tactics. But by him doing that, he made it even worse, because he was playing into DK's game. And I don't think the referee did a great job, because the referee was the show. He was almost a big miraculous for the referee job for the week, when he became the show. And it was just, everything was revolved around him, not the actual fighters. Durrell got the decision, but it was not an entertaining fight. I went up there and I was actually doing some video downloads while watching it out of the corner of my eye. And then the main event was the same thing. I like Sean Porter. We interviewed him. I think he's a hell of a nice guy. He's got a lot of potential. The problem with Sean Porter is Heavy Atlas put it out literally a matter of a week after we interviewed him. He thinks Sean bounces around too much on his third and gets a little too jumpy in there and he doesn't set his feet. And I think that was part of his problem in that fight. He wasn't setting his feet. He was getting jumpy. He wasn't throwing crisp punches. He was throwing, like, clubbing type of ugly, wasn't setting his body. And Brooke was just timing him. That's all he was doing. He was timing him. And he was and using that to, just land his shot and offset Porter's rhythm. And Brooke won the decision, and he deserved it.
Yeah, and I saw a funny post on Twitter yesterday that says it's kind of along the lines of Game of Thrones, if you've ever seen that series. They were talking about winter is coming, and somebody put a picture of the guy got his head cut off up, and the words were, prepare, because posts that say Kell Brook can beat Mayweather are coming.
Yeah, there we go. You're right.
Yes, you know, one win there, no matter how technical or circumstantial it might be, is gonna get people talking about stuff like that, I guess. But I haven't heard too much of a rumble so far on that front. But speaking of Mayweather, there's an interesting guy coming out and saying they're going to make this match in 2015 between Mayweather and Pacquiao to maximize the pay-per-view sales and also for health reasons. This is coming from the former physician of heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali, former heavyweight champion, of course, Ferdy Pacheco, Dr. Ferdy Pacheco, the personal doctor of Muhammad Ali, and he says that he pushed Cassius Clay, former Cassius Clay, to hang up his gloves at the age of 35, but the attraction of higher persons and the fame that went with the title was too much to resist for Ali, who is now paying the price for his decision in terms of suffering from Parkinson's disease. And he wrote an article for the New York Times, which Jacob did, and he explained that if a person loses elasticity and resiliency by age 35 as part of the aging process. He wrote, the simplest way of characterizing the aging process would have to be loss of elasticity. With the loss of elasticity comes the concomitant loss of resiliency, the ability to bounce back, to recover from the injury, whether by natural causes, illnesses, or trauma. So when resiliency is gone, it affects the brain most, linked to the number of punches that landed on the head of the boxer from amateur days all the way to his professional career. Injuries to the body tissues are multiplied when a person ages on top of the effects of the normal aging process, and it would speed up the downhill course. So Pacheco also said that boxing is a young man's game until the age of 30. The body is on the upswing, building itself, getting stronger and stronger. From 30 on, the loss of elasticity and resiliency diminished slowly but progressively deteriorating until a boxer who fights after age 30 is helping nature along the downhill course. So, he also said that a boxer who fights after 35 is, quote, pushing the gas pedal, accelerating toward an early demise and making his trip there uncomfortable. Now, of course, Mayweather's 37. He has three more fights until his contract with Showtime ends. On September 13th, he'll have a rematch with Maidana, who's much younger, at the MGM Grand Las Vegas. Pacquiao is 35, and he's announced plans to quit boxing soon after his contract with Top Rank Promotions ends. In the meantime, he's going to fight 30-year-old WBO junior welterweight champ Chris Algieri in Macau, November 22nd. And also, you know, doing things outside the sport. He's a career, or he's a playing coach of a Philippine basketball team and just bought an interest in one fighting championship. So, guess, you know, we've kind of gotten past whether this Mayweather versus Pacquiao fight is ever going to take place. Seems like it's not even being discussed right now. But it brings up a good point, Pacheco does, about age, and, you know, both of these guys are due to call it a career. And it'd be nice to see them fight each other before they do. It's a long shot. Anyway, we've got Psychic Tom on the air. How's it going, Tom?
Well, I'm just listening. It sounds like Ferdy is not in the crew of 40 is the new 28 or something like that. You know, you hear these cliches about how aging's not like it used to be. Boy, he's sounding like he's really pretty rigid on that. And I would like to ask him, how do you explain Bernard Hopkins? And see what he says.
Right.
Now, I'd really be interested in hearing what he would say about that. And we've had some other guys go on a little longer than that. I mean, I'm obviously a little biased on this, but I mean, hey, us old folks need someone to cheer for too, you know. And I do think that if you compare any athlete today from what was even 20, 30 years ago, I do think that the window's been extended somewhat. And boy, he just, because I remember at one point he was saying, when you're 35, your license is pulled. That's what he was advocating at one point. That's it. You're done. No exceptions. And I just still think it's an individual basis. You know, it should be on the individual fighter, because had Bernard had his license pulled 14 years ago, think of what we would have missed out on all this time.
Well, you know what the funny thing is? And you brought up a great point there. Bernard's biggest career-defining win, if you look back and you go over his Hall of Fame career, you say, what if you say what is Bernard's greatest win? What would you say it is?
There's just been so many off the top of my head here. I mean,
I write a couple preview articles, and I said, "Oh, Hopkins, you've read my articles before." How I always write the fighter's three best performances. This is the one I've had as his number one performance for all the years I've been doing this.
How about Kelly Pavlik?
That was a good fight, but that's not one of the ones I have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously Roy Jones Jr., but Roy was so past his prime by that point that I don't know. I can't say that would. Okay. Whoa. I'm sorry. Felix Trinidad.
Ding, ding, ding.
I'm a little slow tonight, okay?
Just a few months ago, I was messing around on YouTube, and it was early Saturday morning, and when he woke me up early, he wanted me to go out to the bathroom, and I was like, yeah, you know, I was going to jump on the computer, and recommended the video to watch was the whole fight. It was like 6 in the morning, I wasn't going back to bed. I'm like, it was a Saturday morning, going to have to go to work. I thought I was going to watch this on the computer today, all 48-plus minutes of it. So I sat down, I started watching it. And I remember watching it that night at my house, and my trainer was there. And it reminds me of it now, was probably was saying something because he had some doozies, the worst commentating performance of George Foreman's career. Because he was babbling some nonsense the entire fight. And the one thing he said, and I said, and I'm thinking, George, you're a guy that came back at 38 years old. The last thing you should be criticizing is a fighter for being too old. But
another
said,
example.
He goes, around the fifth or sixth round, I think it was the sixth round, if you go back, you'll hear it. And he's like, Hopkins, you know, 36-year-old legs are starting to wear down on him. He's starting to wear down at 36. And he kept making the point of 36. Mm-hmm. Which, if he would have had that mandatory 35-year-old retirement,
more
than a year before the best win of his career.
Yeah, a very, very good point. And again, like the problem with him saying that is no one had told Trinidad. Trinidad didn't get that script that apparently George was writing. But and then George himself coming back, and And how many people back in the 80s, I mean, I'll be honest, when I first heard it, I mean, I've always had so much respect for him, following him in the 70s, but, you know, when I seen this 300-pound lump of lard, I'm thinking, well, he's got the power, but can he, you know, what's the old cliche? You can have a missile, but you need you need something to get that missile on target. You need a guidance system there, and I just was really questioning that, but George kept going. He kept going, and sure enough, we've seen it happen in his mid-40s, which would have been unheard of years ago. So, I don't know.
That's why we call it the Michael Moore grill, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yes, to our interview with Michael Moore, we'll get that one.
If you go back to that fight, the other thing on there, you'll notice, Larry Merchant can be a great. I've always said that. And there were times, even after this fight, that Larry, him and Hopkins verbally sparred in the ring. I remember at the Murad Hakkar fight in Philadelphia. Terribly overmatched number one contender. And Larry Merchant made a few comments, and Bernard was verbally sparring right back with him. But in that fight at one point, no matter what, in the first few rounds, that Hopkins or Bill Warren, Foreman was cutting him down. And at one point, Larry Merchant even said, George, what do you have against Bernard Hopkins? And George was like, I ain't got nothing against Bernard Hopkins. I love Bernard Hopkins. And Larry made like an underhanded comment, like, really? The gym will sound like it. Yeah, go back and watch that fight. And now it's like, this is the fight. It's coming up on 13 years. It'll be 13 years next month. Right?
Yeah.
And who would have thought that the man at 36 years old at the time, only 3 months shy of his 37th birthday, would still be out there on a world championship level?
Exactly. Oh, one thing, Tony, I wanted to comment. I heard you describing that Porter fight, and I remember it was a couple years ago when he was on Friday Night Fights when Teddy was bringing that. Well, that whole bouncy pogo stick style,
yeah.
And he was mentioning that, you know, when you're bouncing up and down like that, you can't sit down in your punches, and that's that amateur habit. Now, I was kind of under the impression that Porter was really working to get past that. Now, you're saying that you've seen some of that in this Brook fight. He kind of reverted back to that.
Yeah, if you go back, I'm good. I wouldn't even recommend watching the fight because it really wasn't that entertaining of a fight. But, upon watching it, it was, like, Brooks was just, here, basically the way I can describe it, Brooks was very composed and almost to, like, the point of real smooth. And Snyder was herky-jerky, and he was jumping. And he was jumping in there, and he was trying to attack, but when he was jumping in, he was throwing his punches. He was throwing, like, he was trying to win some, like, power punches in there, but he was jumping in so much that he was almost, like he was going to throw a body shot. He was almost wrapping it around and going behind him, you know, because he was, like, jumping in too much. He wasn't landing the punches solidly. And basically, Brook was just, you know, just pumping his jab, moving, using angles, and just, you know, every time, even every time that Porter tried to jump in and work with the timer and snap a jab right in his face. And it was like literally standing him straight up every time he would do that.
Huh. Wow. What a step back. Now, did you see Porter against Paulie Maginelli? Did you see that one?
Yes, I did. And that fight, he looked good, but at the same time, when he fought Malinagi was, you know, Malinagi, we would bounce a lot. And with that fight, it was almost like a polar opposite. And Porter just being so much physically stronger and physically dominant was just, I mean, I'm trying to think of the best term to say it, but he was just, I mean, battering to a point. He was just getting in there, and no matter what Paulie would do, he was just overwhelming him. I think that's the best word I can use for that fight, overwhelming him. And with with that fight, Paulie was doing a lot of bouncing, and I think Charlo, every time he would just jump in on him, his physical strength was the difference, where in this fight, I don't think his physical strength made a difference.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge setback, because there was even talk of a few fights down the road, if Porter kept looking impressive, that maybe Mayweather was in his radar screen, but boy, that sure has set that back.
Wow.
Well, boxing, we got another interesting story here. I'm sure you guys have heard of a guy named James Page. He was known as Mikey Quinn.
Didn't he welcome you, champ, back in like the 90s?
Yeah. Well, we talked about him before because he's been in the news for getting involved with some bank robberies. He did an 11-year stint that ended in 2012 for bank robbery. And at that time, he said he was, quote, a young 39, unquote. So another example of a guy trying to come back past his, quote, prime, according to Ferdy. But someone asked him at that time, do you think you can get back to the promise? Do you think you can get back to the promised land? And he said, I guarantee you I can. And instead of doing that, he went back to robbing banks. And,
not good.
He ended up having one fight in his comeback. He lost his split decision to Robert West in 1996. And actually, this is a backstory here. But anyway, skipping back a little bit, back in 1996, he was arrested for theft from the Concord gym where he worked out. He served 10 months in San Quentin, and that began a disturbing pattern for Page, a boxing match loss followed by an arrest and incarceration. After his release from prison in 1998, Page was picked up by promoter Don King. He quickly claimed the welterweight boxing world boxing title, knocking out Russian Andrei Pestriev in two rounds. He then successfully defended the belt three times, but he was stripped of his title in November of 2000 for failing to show up for a mandatory fight. And in 2001, he lost to Andrew Lewis and about to regain the vacant title. At the same time, Page was entrenched in illegal contract battles with King and had struggles with alcohol, according to reports at the time. Later that year, he was arrested for robbing an Atlanta bank and then sent to that 11 years in federal prison that ended in 2012. So hoping for a comeback, he got his boxing license when he was released from prison in 2012, but in November of that year, he lost the fight that was meant to be his ticket back into boxing. Just 4 months later, police say Page started robbing East Bay banks, taking more than $20,000 in 8 heists in Pleasant, Oakley, Emeryville, Lafayette, Walnut Creek, and Antioch between March and early June. I think those are in California. And he was dubbed the button-down bandit by the FBI for his long-sleeved collared shirts, and then he was arrested shortly after an Oakley police officer recognized him in the bank surveillance video. And he accepted a plea deal in the case. He was also never armed. So he was expecting, actually he was slated to receive up to 20 years in prison. He actually got sentenced just over 7. So he kind of lucked out. But the real interesting twist here is that he actually submitted brain scans so that they can be reviewed by a neurologist. And the brain images are supposed to be used to determine if Page suffers from traumatic encephalopathy, a neurodegenerative disease that can affect boxers subjected to repeated blows to the head. And, of course, that's been making headlines in the National Football League lawsuits. So it's interesting to see this come into a criminal case, blaming the boxing, saying that boxing affected the part of the brain that impairs judgment. His lawyer says, I know for a fact he took some tremendous shots during his comeback. He was older, he wouldn't back down, and these guys hit him and hit him hard.
Okay, so how old will he be when he gets out? He'll be, what, 47?
I don't know what age he is now. He was 39 in 2012, so...
Okay. So he'll be 47 full. Well, he'll be under 50. It's not too late. Maybe he's got a good fight or two left in him. Oh, wow. How about that?
Well, the problem is if they found that his brain scans show CTE, then, you know, he shouldn't be boxing at all.
Well, it's going to be awful hard for him to get a reversal on that. I mean, that's just the way the system is. Good luck to him, but...
He started at the age of 8, so he actually does have a lot of experience, and I think that would affect the brain for sure. I don't know so much. I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week with all the domestic violence situations, and I think we do have a story somewhere in here about War Machine getting busted. He got caught finally. Going along the lines of brain injury, we got a UFC story. Actually, not UFC anymore, but a UFC vet is in the news. He's quitting after an 11-year career that was spent in mostly the major organizations like the UFC and the IFL. Christoph Szymanski actually was famous years ago for saying 85% of the athletes in MMA are using some kind of illegal drugs. He mentioned that and kind of created an uproar at the time. His nickname, the Polish Experiment. He's 37 years old, and he hasn't fought since a 35-second loss to Igor Poprzak in late 2011. And he was 3-1 before that setback, beating Brian Stann, Stefan Bonner, and Goran Rutherford. And this last fight, he said, it was my first time getting literally knocked out cold. My brain didn't wake up for probably 40 minutes until after the fight. There's an interview, and I'm having an interview, and I don't remember any of that stuff. I just remember walking into the octagon, waking up. I already had my clothes, shower, and all that. And UFC matchmaker Joe Silva thinking everything is going to be okay, and they're ready for you to go to the hospital to get your CT scan, like UFC always does when a fighter gets knocked out. Szymanski actually did want one more fight, but after a six-month layoff, he was targeted for a December 2012 bout and began his training camp. But then he took one shot from a lightweight sparring partner in his first session, and that was it. He kicked me in the face and the jaw once, and he said, no more. Szymanski is a three-time Fight Night bonus winner. He posted 21 stoppages and 26 career wins. And he talked to the UFC's president, Dana White, and Dana conferred with his wife and son and him and figured out it was time to retire. So he's got memory lapses. He's unable to count backward from 20 to 0, and he said he knew it was time to call it quits. And he actually was brought to Vegas by the UFC for a full workup, and he actually had some difficulty with the memory tests. He says he no longer watches TV, reads a lot of books and stories on brain issues, takes recommended supplements, and he's talked to other fighters about their own experiences. However, he said that while the Inside MMA interview took place on Friday, he couldn't really remember anything from 2 days prior. It's not getting worse, but it's not getting any better, he said. Yesterday I spoke with my wife, and today I'll probably ask the same questions I asked yesterday, because I don't remember the answers to those questions. I guess that's a convenient part of it, huh?
Wow.
Yeah, honey. Yeah, sure, I'll do that. Well, what did you want me to do again? He doesn't have any dizzy spells, doesn't have any long-term memory loss or anything like that. It's just small little things that you take for granted. So that's an interesting story. I think, you know, you haven't really heard too much along the lines of fighters retiring because of brain issues. But I guarantee you that this sort of thing is going to become the norm sooner or later. We're going to start seeing the floodgates open. Mark Bocek also recently retired from MMA. We talked a little bit about this last week, but he kind of went off on a tangent recently and expanded on his reasoning and some of his responses which surprised me. He said that obviously performance enhancing drugs in the sport was a concern, and he says the UFC is not concerned enough with it. And he also added, like we just talked about, the possibility of sustaining brain damage. Those were the two main reasons he said that he wanted to hang up the gloves at the age of 32. But he had another complaint during a recent interview on the MMA Hour, and it has nothing to do with getting hit in the head or PEDs. He says, this is an exact interview, realistic enough direction MMA is going. You know, striking, stand-up, female MMA, that's the direction it's heading in. It's difficult for an obese woman MMA fighter to get in, but if she has different skills and has cool bikini shots, she can get in. I'm just saying that's the direction of MMA and MMA fans pushing the female MMA. Ronda Rousey, technically the best fighter, and we'll put experienced, accomplished male fighters on undercards, but we'll put females last year on co-main events. That direction was kind of the persuasion that forced me to get out. I'm not a female, you know, but that's the direction it's heading. Girls, Honda, people just overcame Alaska. MMA is great. I just don't think it should be compared to males' MMA just because I think it's different. I have nothing against women's MMA like people think. All I was getting at was if you want to do women's MMA, that's great. Why not just have a women's MMA league? The events changed for me once they were having female MMA events where you had someone who had been doing judo their whole life, say, fighting a Marine who just started training 2 years ago. That's not the same talent or depth. It's not difficult to confuse people because, let's face it, they're sucker-born every minute, right? And obviously, he's talking about Ronda Rousey versus Liz Carmouche there, which is the first fight on the UFC scene for female fighters back in February of 2000. And basically, he's kind of pissed that the females are getting all the advantages while some of the males are getting overlooked. I'm not sure if I agree with him there, but obviously, certain females are getting preferential treatment, but. You have way less of them than you have the guys right now to choose from. So, it's granted it's going to be that way. Bellator is in the news for Eddie Alvarez again. Eddie Alvarez was made a free agent just the other day. And Scott Coker said, we granted Eddie his unconditional release this morning. Eddie is free to explore the free agent market. We wish him the best in the future. After sitting down with him and getting to know him, it was just a very hurtful thing. I think the damage was already done. Clearly there was a wall, and that it was not directly beat. And Alvarez, of course, came up with his own statement. He said this was a long process, but it's a decision that everyone seems happy with. I think it's important to say that I am genuinely thankful for the time at Bellator. I know that sounds a little crazy given everything I went through, but I've fought there since 2009. And have been involved in some really amazing fights. The staff there always treated me great, and I'm going to miss seeing a lot of those familiar faces around for sure. Myself and my team had some really good discussions with Scott, but in my heart, I knew I was ready to move on and start the next chapter of my career. And, of course, he didn't waste any time starting that chapter. He's going to be fighting Donald Cerrone at UFC 178, which will do good to replace the lost fight of John Jones versus Stanley Jones. Green was supposed to face Bobby Green at the event, but Green was shifted to a later date with an opponent yet to be named. Now Cerrone's been on a tear lately. Finished Evan Dunham, Adriano Martins, Edson Barboza, and Jim Miller on a four-fight win streak. And Eddie Alvarez is pretty much been on the shelf, hasn't had much to do. And speaking of the John Jones injury, Alistair Overeem is being blamed for that, even though they're technically saying it was an accident. But Anthony Johnson, who also is training, working with John Jones. Actually, not working with John Jones, but has worked with Alistair Overeem in the past, and he's come out and pretty much confirmed Overeem does not fight fair.
Well, you know, my only comment on that is when you hear something once, maybe you can dismiss it, but when you keep hearing the same thing again and again and again and again, well, what's that old saying about preponderance of evidence? And if he's doing this in the gym, it makes it even more despicable. I think all of us can agree on that, that the gym is not the place to go out and try to seriously hurt your training partners.
And the other injury he's supposedly responsible for is Andre Arlovsky. He's fighting, he's training for another fight with Bigfoot Silva. So obviously Overeem is a pretty good opponent to work with, but not according to his statements here. He says, "I do not like to wash dirty linen in public, but in these words, there is a weighty truth. A few days ago, I was sparring with Alistair Overeem and experienced firsthand how it can end. As usual sparring goes, men represent strikes, touch each other, but do not tend to cause real damage to the partner. During one of the highlights of our sparring, Overeem hit me with the hardest knee kick in the stomach. In a real fight, it would turn out for me by knockout. After that, I immediately went to the hospital to make sure that my ribs were not broken. Thank God everything turned out okay, although at first we were afraid that my fight with Bigfoot would be canceled. It was so unexpected and so unpleasant that at first I even wanted to take revenge on him, at least hit him with his elbow. But my boxing coach, Andre Ivchuk, turned around and reassured me, do not be like the people who allow themselves to such dirty tricks. No need to stoop to their level. Now I know that Overeem injured John Jones simply because he injures everyone with whom he trains." So,
And I would also bring up the point that how many different training camps, how many different teams has Overeem been with throughout his career? I think it's considerable.
Yeah. Well, he left the Black Zillions, then he ended up at Greg Jackson's camp. And Greg Jackson claims that the injury to Jones was a legit accident, but all the stop from a different teammate can't be made up. So we'll see. We'll see how that works out. But Alistair Overeem needs to learn how to turn it down a notch, I guess. At the same time, he has to know how to turn it up a notch when it comes to fighting. He needs to be injuring people in the ring, not in the freaking training. He hasn't been able to string together, you know, a lot of impressive wins lately, so hopefully he can get it together and find another training partner. Anyway, Jay-Z is getting into boxing. I don't know if you guys heard about this one. He's got this sports agency called Rock Nation Sports. And according to ESPN, Rock Nation Sports won a purse bid on Monday at WBO headquarters in San Juan to secure the promotional rights to a mandatory fight between middleweight title holder Peter Quillin and Matt Korobov. Golden Boy Promotions represents Quillin. Korobov promoters top rank. And the minimum bid was $200,000. The first bid took place because Golden Boy and Top Rank declined to negotiate the fight with each other. Rock Nation's tentative plan is to put the fight on November 8th in New York or Washington, D.C., the two places it has obtained a license to promote boxing. It is still has to negotiate a television deal. David Itzkowicz is the newly hired chief operating officer for Rock Nation. And, of course, he has some background in television. He was with Showtime before. Or HBO, one of the two. He's definitely been around the block. Zeroes. And of course, can't neglect to mention War Machine. The War Machine, the manhunt is over. He was captured very easily, I might add. And, you know, I was really actually very surprised with the MMA media, because I first heard about his capture on Twitter, and I was directed right to a news report where they actually interviewed a witness who was at this hotel in Simi Valley where War Machine was caught. And, of course, most of the MMA blips on this story were, you know, just that he was caught. He had 7 warrants out for him, you know, describing the situation that led to his arrest in the first place and his fugitive. But no details on how he was caught. And I think that's the most classic, ridiculous part of this whole story, because here's this guy. We also found out who he beat up, too. It was a guy from some reality show I never heard of. But anyway, he ended up getting 2 black eyes and a broken nose, and left the house, and then War Machine beat up Christy Mack, his ex-girlfriend. But the reason why War Machine was caught, now, he's staying at a Simi Valley, California hotel. He's wanted in Las Vegas. And he's there with another girl. And they start to get into a verbal argument in the hotel room. And not only a very verbal argument, but an argument so loud that half the people in the other hotel rooms can hear these people. And, like, the walls are rumbling from this dude just yelling. And, you know, obviously if you think you're innocent and you're on the run, the last thing you want to do is make a shitload of noise. And then, you know, get into an argument with a woman to the point of almost hitting her when you're on the run for hitting another woman. You know? So obviously, maybe there's some truth to this getting hit in the head too much. Impairing your judgment, because it's just absolutely stupid. I'm not advocating anybody, you know, stay on the run when you should turn yourself in. But, I mean, if you're going to try to be on the run, you got to be smart about it.
Like, well, hopefully he'll get some help. But wow, man, what can you say?
At his rate, he might as well have turned himself in. I mean, what else do you think is going to happen? Right, so I don't know if that's a steroid thing or just a mentality thing. He's obviously had some brushes with the law before, so I guess it's not too much of a surprise, but, yeah, like Tom said, maybe we'll get some help. We'll see. We had UFC Fight Night Vader versus St. Pro last Saturday. Pretty interesting fight card. I actually kind of dozed off during the Ross Pearson versus Gray Maynard fight, so I did not get to see the main event. But Ryan Bader won pretty convincingly over OSP. Tom likes to call him.
Yeah, I think Ryan fought a very smart fight. I mean, it wasn't the most exciting barn burner I've ever seen, but he used his wrestling very smart, used it when he needed to, showed some good lateral movement with his boxing, and OSP had some very unconventional strikes, but Bader was able to counter him and got the decision.
I think I saw most of the first round of the Pearson versus Maynard fight, but I did not get to see the TKO in the second round, so I'll have to fill me in on how that went down.
Yeah, that was very painful. I thought Gray had done pretty good in the first round, and second round everything was seemed to be going okay, but I have to get back to what you've been harping on, Rich, and what we've been talking about for the past year around here is that lack of defense. That it seemed like Gray would at some moments, his hands would just be so low. I mean, I know it's hard to do things perfect, but again, we're right back on that again, and it didn't take much this time. I think Ross landed a couple shots that staggered Gray, and then when he went down, it was pretty much over, and the ref did give him every chance. But Pearson just kept on loading, and it was a good stoppage. I hated to see it, but it is what it is. So from what I've heard, Gray wants to keep his career going. So he's going to have some more tests done. I guess he was going to a facility back in North Dakota, South Dakota, someplace there, where they were doing some neurological testing on him and been cleared to fight. So he's going to go through that again, and then him and his manager are going to come back and talk to Dana White and see if there's any future for him in the UFC. So best of luck to him.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess this thing they did for Szczesny, putting him through all these tests and all that, is probably going to be a standard for future situations where guys are wondering if they should retire. And it's a good step in the right direction, I think, if they're going to take that seriously and recommend that to these guys before they make their decisions if they're going to get a battery.
Well,
test.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's an individual thing, because from how many times in boxing have we seen guys get knocked out? Maybe once, but it doesn't become a pattern. So, and then you hear that cliche, too, that if you've been knocked out once, it's so much easier for it to happen in the future. So I still say it's an individual case, but I don't know. With Gray, you really got to wonder how much those wars with Frankie Edgar took out of him.
Right. And one of my favorite fights, because it was the hometown guy that ended up prevailing, was Tim Boetsch versus Brad Tavares.
Yeah, and that was like a Rocky movie. That was a movie fight. That was something out of a movie. Oh, my God.
It was his butt kicked left and right all over the cage. It seemed like the ref was going to step in any second to stop the fight, and Tim was going to let down the hometown fans, and then out of nowhere, he just came back and started laying the smack down and just totally turned the tables and TKO'd Brad Tavares in the second round.
Tavares looked very sharp early on. I mean, he was putting everything together, and it looked like it was going to be a bad night for the hometown guy. And, boy, he made the fans happy. That's for sure.
Kind of reminded me of Cathal Pendred and Mike King, even though Mike King was on steroids.
Yeah.
But, wow. Pretty impressive part there. We also had a first-round knockout, Alan Juban beat Seth Pazinski by KO from punches the first round at the 4:23 mark. The heavyweight Sean Jordan and Jack May fought to a TKO in the third round, also by punches. That was at the 3 mark. We had Tiago Tavares wrapped up a nice rear naked choke on Robbie Peralta at the 4:27 mark of round one. Jussie De Silva beat Zach Mikowski by unanimous decision. Sarah McMahon beat Lauren Murphy by split decision. Tom Watson beat Sam Alvey by unanimous decision. And Frankie Sins, first fight of the night, beat Nolan Kickman by unanimous decision. And, of course, we got two fights from the UFC this weekend. One of them is caused enough controversy to lead to some major calls for drug testing, which have been answered, I guess. We'll talk about Michael Bisping versus Kung Lee. This is kind of an interesting one because it's in Macau, and typically when it's overseas, the UFC does its own testing, so pretty inside their own protocol. And this week, apparently, a picture went viral of Kung Lee after a weigh-in, where he had just finished a workout, and this is according to him. You know, he had all his muscles pumped up and his veins ripping out, and just took a picture, and it looks like he's a full-time, 100% dedicated bodybuilder. Pretty jacked up. So, you know, of course, a lot of people were saying he must be on something, and Kung Lee kind of laughed it off. The only thing he admitted taking was Yohimbe when they kind of pressed him. So, he just said, happened to be that matter of time. You know, they caught me at that time. That's what I look like. So I wish I looked like that and everything, but I don't. But now they're going to do full urine and busting for this fight, just in case he is on the juice. And speaking of a guy late in his career, he's 40s, 42 years old. So, maybe it's...
Well, I would say, remember, 42 is the new 29, okay? You know, this, you got me thinking, just to hold that thought of yours, but you got me thinking about Ferdy Pacheco, and I want to ask you guys, if you remember a lot of his announcing, he had a name, well, his official nickname was the Fight Doctor. But some people turned it around and were calling him the Fright Doctor, because he was really one of these stop-the-fight-quick guys a lot of times. But I don't know, Tony, what do you think? Do you remember him back when he was announcing? Do you think he was a little too quick sometimes to call for stoppages? What do you think?
Well, you know what? I'm trying to remember his announcing career. I remember many days. I always remember CBS. I remember him being on CBS. I am just trying to think exactly, you know, what he would say on there. And honestly, I can't remember. I
of course,
cannot
well,
remember
yeah,
either
yeah.
He didn't stand out to me, or it was just, I kind of blocked it from my memory.
Well, no, it's not so much that. That's on me, because I think by the late 80s, he wasn't announcing too much anymore. And I'm going back to the early 80s, and so you're excused for you're excused for those days, bud, okay? But I don't, like, he would just, there were times when he would just, oh, he's a mess, oh, and just, you know, rant and rave about that. And, I mean, we all want fighter safety, but it comes down to the fact this is a fight. And he would get so emotional about this stuff sometimes. I found myself yelling at the television, saying, just shut up. The referee will make the decision. The corner will make the decision. But,
you know, Tom,
anyways.
You're saying that, kind of what I remember is back when he was still doing the announcing, because, like I said, we had more fights on network TV back in the late 80s and still
right.
Into the 90s. I remember watching some on Saturday and Sunday afternoons in the 90s. Because back then, he said the TV guy, and I remember each week when the TV guy would come out, because you didn't have the internet like you do now. I remember
yeah.
I was always singing to, like, ABC Wide World of Sports and all that on the Saturday and Sunday to see if they were going to have any live fights on. And it's happened to become less and less and less and less. But that's when I also started getting into a lot of boxing magazines. And it's starting to, like, you know, like the fog is, like, clearing up a little bit. And I remember somebody writing an article or a letter, like, saying he was a terrible announcer. I can't tell you who it was, but I am, like, remembering, like, things like, oh, yeah, he's terrible. Like, you know, you have a sick of being a doctor, or you have a sick of doing this, but he's a terrible announcer. You don't know how these coattails, you just see like that.
Well, I mean, He had definitely had some pedigree background with Ali, and he knew the game quite well. But I mean, it was just sometimes a little too much. Like I said, just a little too much of that. Or he earned his name, the Fright Doctor, sometimes. But anyways, we can move on. Just.
Well, on that card also we have Tyron Woodley facing Dong Hyun Kim. Dong Hyun Kim is 19. As you might expect, the card is in Macau, China. Almost every single fight except the first fight of the night involves at least one Asian. We've got first fight of the night is two females. Melina Dudieva. I don't know how to pronounce that one, but she's 10-3, fighting Elizabeth Phillips, who's 4-2. Then we got Royston Wee, 3-0, fighting Zhutui Yao. Definitely butchering that one. He doesn't have a picture in here. He's 1-1. Then we have a guy who only needs an NO in his first name to become an annoying Wang. Anying Wang, this guy's name. His real name. He's on the Wang team. He's also fighting Colby Covington, who's 5-0. I don't have any picture on SureDoc, so something. We have Roland DeLorme on the card. He's 9-3, fighting Ivan Sasaki, 17-1-2. We got Alberto Mina, who's 10-0, fighting Shinsho Anzai, who's 8-1. Danny Mitchell, 14-5-1, fighting Wang Tsai, who's 6-5. And we have Guan Yu Ning, who's 3-2-1, fighting Jianping Yang, who's 6-3-1. We got Ning and Yang. Ning and Yang. We've got Lifeng Zhang, 7-7-1, fighting Brendan O'Reilly, who's 5-1. So that rounds out the Macau card. I'm imagining that's probably going to start early today, and then the other Saturday night card will be in the evening hours, I guess. Henderson versus Dos Anjos is the other main event. Benson Henderson, Rafael Dos Anjos, I believe. Taking a minute. That one, I think, is coming from Oklahoma. And just a second. The co-main event there is Jordan Main, who's 28-9, fighting Mike Pyle, who's 26-9-1. These first three fights. We also have Francis Carmont, 22-9, fighting Haley Leakey, who's 28. There. But then in the main event, he's 21-3, fighting Rafael Dos Anjos, who's 27. We also have Max Holloway, 9-3, fighting Clay Collard, 13-4. James Vick, undefeated at 5-0, fighting Valmir Lazaro, who's 12. We got Chaz Skelly, 11-1, fighting Minamaki, who's 21-6-1. Alex Garcia, 12-1, fighting Bill Magny, who's 11-3. Benil Dariush, 7-1, fighting Tony Martin, who's 8-1. Matt Hobar, 8-2, fighting Aaron Phillips, who's 5-1. And Saunders back in action. He's 16-6-2, fighting Chris Heatherly, who's 8-1. And in the first fight on the card, we have Wilson Reese, 17-5, fighting Joby Sanchez, who's 6-0. That is from Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you're in the area, you can watch that. We got, of course, lots of boxing this weekend. Friday Night Fights, big one. Oscar Trout versus Daniel Dawson. Trout's 26-2 with 14 knockouts. Dawson is 40-3. 40 wins, 3 losses, 1 draw, 26 knockouts. This is a 12-round light middleweight fight. No belt on the line, though. Coming from Temecula, California tomorrow night. The co-main event is a 10-round welterweight fight between Eric Bone, who's 14-1. With 8 knockouts, and Mehanri Montes, who's 29-3-1, 21 knockouts. Pretty interesting fights on the card. We got Devontae Starks at light middleweight, 8-rounder. He's 9-0 with 6 knockouts, fighting Arturo Urena with 20 wins, 17 losses, and 1 draw with 16 knockouts to his credit. And nothing else really jumping out at me on this one. Also on Friday night, we have a Golden Boy live card from USA Fox Sports 1. Main event there is Manuel Avila, who's 15-0 with 6 knockouts. And he's fighting Sergio Frias, who's 15-3-2 with 8 knockouts at the 10-round super bantamweight bout. We got a couple Okay, 8-round fights, one at heavyweight, one at featherweight. The heavyweights are Gerald Washington, 13-0 with 10 knockouts, and Navi Aguilera, 19-8 with 13 knockouts. The featherweights are Guy Robb, 13-1 with 5 knockouts, fighting Ronel Green, who's 10-0 with 5 knockouts. So, that's Friday night for you. Got a lot going on Saturday as well. First, I want to mention down in Tampa, Florida, we have a world title on the line and a female fight in the main event. 10-round welterweight fight between Chevelle Halbach, who's 29-8-2 with 12 knockouts, fighting Victoria Cisneros, who's 11-15-2 with 4 knockouts. That's for the vacant World Boxing Federation female featherweight title. And I don't know if this is any relation to old Dr. Ferdy, but Eric Pacheco is on this card. And if it is any relation, Ferdy's not doing a good job because Eric is 0-3. Good. So, I'll go to Saturday. Saturday, we actually have a lot going on in a lot of different areas, but not too much title shots. We got Ty Cobb fighting this weekend. Anyway, Ty Cobb down in Oklahoma, where the UFC is going on. We got Ty Cobb with 17-5 with 10 knockouts, fighting Richard Dawson with 5-1-2. Main event there. What? We got George Tadunipa, I don't even know how to pronounce that one. That's a tough one. Tadunipa. He's 33-1-2 with 24 knockouts, fighting Tracy Sneed in the main event there. Sneed is 27-2 with 21 knockouts. That's pretty much the headliner on that card. Shannon Briggs obviously didn't hurt himself too bad the other day in his tussle with Vladimir Klitschko. He's fighting this weekend in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, at the Ring of Dreams Boxing Gym. And this is the only 10-round fight on the card. He's 55-6-1, Briggs is, with 48 knockouts. He's fighting Corey Phelps, who's 16-6-1, with just 8 knockouts. Make this, even today, Thursday night, every single other person on the card is fighting TBA. Everyone.
Ever. Wow.
TBA, TBA, TBA. Unbelievable. So you got only an opponent for the main. We have a main event in Bulgaria. It's pretty interesting. Borislava Goranova. He's 10-39 with one draw, fighting Sylvia Kamenova, who's making his pro debut. Right there. Good stuff going on in Okinawa and the Philippines on Sunday. Nothing too crazy. Well, this is definitely the mismatch of the week. We got one of the biggest mismatches of the week I think we've ever had here. 12-round heavyweight fight for the Bolivian heavyweight title on Tuesday. Next Tuesday from Benny Bolivia, here in the area. Saul Farah has 50 wins, 18 losses, and 3 draws with 44 knockouts.
Whoa!
So that means 6 of his wins have come by decision. Saul Farah in heavyweight. He is fighting Bernardino Fernandez. Guess what his record is?
I'm all ears.
2-1.
Two and one.
Man, Bernardino Fernandez. Fighting a guy with 50 wins. He has only 2 wins. And not only is he fighting Fernandez this weekend, but on the 6th of December, on the 6th of September, just a couple weeks later here, Sol Pará is set to face a guy who's going to be the mismatch of the week for that week, because this guy, he might be named Popeye. That's his last name. John Okita Popeye. And he's 0-4, so he needs spinach.
Well, I would tell both of them, hey, come on, the guy's knocked out a lot of people, but he ain't fought you yet, okay? Who's he fought? No one. No one. You're going to get in here and show him, okay? He hits you, you just laugh at him and say, I ain't going down. That's what you do, right?
This is a rematch, wow. Believe it or not, for Popeye, who's 0-4.
A rematch?
His second fight. He's fought Sol Farah in only his second fight. He's off by unanimous decision.
Oh, so we didn't get knocked out. Whoa,
and this guy, Fernandez, who's fighting Saturday, was Popeye's first fight.
you gotta wonder, is there a dearth of heavyweights down there in Bolivia? That's fascinating. I wonder how many of those 50 wins, how many of those were 2 and 3 and 4 times fighting?
Well, we'll check it out, I guess. I'm waiting for Sean Wheelock. He's going to be calling in about 10 minutes or so. Yeah, he's... last big fight was against Billy Wright back in June? Yep, June of this year. Billy Wright was 43-4. He lost that one by TKO, and guess what he lost? He lost the WBC Latino heavyweight title, the WBC Speaker Box heavyweight title, and the WBC Asian Boxing Council heavyweight title. So now he's just the Bolivian heavyweight champ.
God, you know, I have to refrain from saying there's too many titles. It sounds so redundant, but I don't know. It's just, where does it stop?
Yeah, it looks like every time he's fought anybody with a significant amount of wins, he's lost. You got Billy Wright a couple times. Chauncey Welliver, he lost to him back in 2013. Welliver was 54-7-5 at the time. He saw got TKO'd in round 3. Let's see, we go back to 3 losses in a row. 2011, Johan Duhaupas beat him. He was 25-1, TKO'd him in the second round. Before that, Irino Beato Costa Jr. was 5-0 and beat Farah by TKO in the second round. And then before that, George Arias, 45-11, retired in the second round for the South American heavyweight title. And then before that, he lost to Gonzalo Omar Basile, and Basile was 41-4. And a bunch of titles there. Yeah. Anytime anybody's got over 10 wins, it looks like this guy has trouble with him. A whole bunch of losses against that type of fighter. But he's had a lot of belts. Got to give him that. So that's it for the boxing schedule this week.
Agra, Palma, Philippines,
Chi-Town, Chicago, John George, and Diehard Davis. Main event there. Let's just see, these gentlemen. John George, 25-2, 22 knockouts. Diehard Davis is 22-4 with 10 knockouts. What are John George's next fight?
Sometimes that happens. Anyway,
yeah,
should be getting Sean calling in at any minute here. Let's see, while we're waiting, Don King. Did you send him a birthday card, Tony? 83 years old, Don King.
I did not, but I wish him a happy one now. Happy birthday, only in America.
Oh. Yeah. Doesn't really discuss much. So I guess he was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1931. Some people may not know he was charged with murder in two separate incidents. He ran an illegal bookmaking operation before he became a promoter. One of the situations was determined justifiable homicide because he shot a man in the back while he was attempting to rob one of the King's gambling houses. 13 years later, King of second-degree murder, found guilty of stomping to death and allegedly owed him money back in 1966. The ruling was eventually changed to non-negligent manslaughter, and King served just under 4 years in prison. Of course, he's probably most well-known for managing Tyson during his heyday and stealing all Tyson's money. He sued after a couple of years. And this article lists just a few of the legendary Don King's legal achievements. And like Tony said, he coined the phrase only in America. He was the promoter of over 500 world championship fights so far. Nearly 100 boxers under his management have earned a million or more. Promoted the Jackson 5's Jackson's Victory Tour in 1984. It grossed $150 million. Don King then brokered an enormous product endorsement deal on behalf of Jackson to appear in a series of commercials for Pepsi Cola. He's also the first promoter State 25 world title bout one year, which is 1986. That broke his 23-7 in 1986. Named Promoter of the Year by the World Boxing Association for 1986. Promoted an unprecedented 13 world champions exclusively and was the first promoter to stage 23 world championship fights in the same year, 1982. He was the first promoter to pay $30 million to a boxer, and Mike Tyson received that amount to face World Boxing Council champion Frank Bruno at the MGM Grand back on March 16th, 1996. And a flashy boxing promoter known as George Washington Duke, played by Richard Grant in the film Rocky V, is a parody of Don King, in case you didn't know.
Yeah.
And I'll sue.
But I was bored the other week and I was Rocky Five is on. I'm like, ooh, Rocky Five is on. Let me watch that. It's like so thinly disguised. It's like almost like, what was that movie back years ago with Bogart and Gene Seeger? Part of They Fall or whatever. But it was, hey, basically a mockery of Primo Canera, where he's not a fighter, he's huge, he's big, he's 7 feet tall, but he can't fight, so they're paying guys to take dives. And then even in the movie, there's like Max Baer, who's, fighting, they had a different name in the movie, but it's played by Max Baer, and beats the hell out of this guy and knocks him down like 10 times. Just like he did in real life against Canera. They said it was such a thin disguise of Canera that Canera sued, the movie makers. Same thing, Don King could have sued the shit out of Sylvester Stallone for this. He was such a thinly disguised, version of himself. Only in America, and, you gotta do this, and, trying to be all bombastic, and, But at least I get to watch the other week to see the two best lines in the movie.
We have Sean Wheelock with us, joining us, the author of Legal, about the creation of the UFC, co-author with Art Davey. How's it going, Sean?
Thank you so much for having me on the program. And you guys were talking about Don King, and I'm a huge boxing fan. I mean, I'm just a fight fan in general, obviously. MMA is my combat sport of choice, but big pro wrestling fan, especially as a kid in the 80s. Love boxing. I just got back. My 9-year-old does Muay Thai. But in you talking about Don King, you know, King was someone who was a numbers runner, spent time convicted, felon for manslaughter. And what I think Don King really made his mark on the boxing scene, obviously he did so many tremendous things and maybe not so tremendous things, but he promoted my all-time favorite boxing fight, which is Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman in Kinshasa, Zaire. And that was the first $5 million guarantee, which is pretty remarkable if you think for 1974, a $5 million guarantee. And Don King, being Don King, went right to the dictatorial ruler of Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko, and was able to convince him, saying this will be great for your country's tourism, and spend $5 million. It's amazing what he was able to pull off at that time. And Don King's 83 today, is that correct?
80, yep.
Amazing with Don King. And as much as we've talked about Bjorn Rebney, who I'm sure you'll want to ask me about, and Dana White, and now my new boss, Scott Coker, I don't think we'll ever see anywhere in combat sports somebody like Don King.
Yeah, we actually got to see him in person not too long ago. He came up to the Brockton area in Massachusetts for a dedication of a Rocky Marciano statue. And,
he's a big man. I met him in person. He's a very big man. He's deceptively large.
I was lucky enough, I had driven up to Philadelphia, and just being a New England guy, we met up there for the Marciano dedication, because we both know members of the Rocky family. And I got some pictures of Don King relatively up close, and then I'm in the bleachers snapping photos of a bunch of his speeches, and one of my regrets is that I actually didn't film his speech, because his speech was that good. Him and Larry Holmes had the best speeches of the day, and Larry Holmes was amazing just because of 30 years ago with the comment he made, Rocky couldn't carry my jockstrap, which caused a lot of friction. And it was good to see time healing that wound. But when Don King got up there and I got still photos, just how funny it was, he's sitting there and says, Rocky Marciano was the champ of the world. Rocky Marciano, you know, he didn't buck nobody. You know, and Rocky was not a racist man. He didn't care if you were black, if you were white, if you were yellow, if you were green. He'd knock you out just the same. He gave it about 5 or 6 tags, and it was just such a great, great, great speech. Like you said, I wish I would have videoed it.
Yeah,
it's amazing with Don King. And guys, I was just going to say, you know, when boxing was really, really cooking with gas in the 80s and probably early 1990s, that obviously you had Sugar Ray Leonard, you had Mike Tyson, George Foreman, Evander Holyfield, Julio Cesar Chavez, maybe Pernell Whitaker in that group. But Don King was as recognizable as anybody in boxing, maybe second only to Muhammad Ali for contemporaries in the sport. It's amazing as a promoter and as a convicted felon for manslaughter what he was able to achieve.
Yeah.
I mean, breaking through boxing into the general mainstream, even beyond sports fans.
Well, speaking of achievements, you've got this book out there with Art Davey. Tell us a little bit about how that project came about. Obviously, it's a long time after the UFC was purchased by the Fertitta, and long after Art helped create it. So how did you two together, and how did this whole project start?
Well, about 4 years ago, just on a whim, I became a 17-year-old kid again, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to track down Art Davey, and I really felt like Art Davey was the unsung hero in all of this. And you know, I'm an MMA hardcore. I'm one of those people who watched UFC 1 November 12, 1993. My mom paid the $14.95. I was a kid, watched it at home. I had the presence of mind to put a blank VHS tape in my Sony VCR, which I still have. Thankfully, it was very helpful in co-writing the book with Art to be able to watch that original broadcast, because what Vidmark Home Entertainment released a couple of years later is not the full broadcast. You don't see the alternate fight where Jason DeLucia catches Trent Jenkins in a rear naked choke. You don't see a lot of the commentator gaffes from Bill Wallace. So to have the original broadcast is pretty cool. But I was right there. I watched it from the beginning. And I just decided on a whim. I wanted to talk to Art Davie, and I really just thought it would be one phone call. Hey, my name is Sean Wheelock. I'm the Bellator commentator. I used to be a Pride and M1. Just want to let you know I'm really thankful for everything that you've done. So when I reached Art Davie, he knew who I was. He was a fan of the sport. You know, he still watches not just the UFC, but watches Bellator, you know, is a fan of the sport, knew who I was, and a friendship was born. And what I like to tell people, the book came out of our friendship. The friendship didn't come out of our book. As Art and I became close friends, I knew that I wanted to do something to honor his legacy and to be able to tell his story. And we kicked around ideas. Do we try to make a documentary film? Do we pitch this as maybe an hour TV special? What type of book do we try to do? And Art and I hit on the idea, let's tell the story of the first UFC. And that's what our book, Is This Legal, is about. It's not a sweeping history of the UFC. It's not Art Davie's life story or biography. This is Art Davie's first-person memoir that I co-wrote about the 4 years of his life that he spent, basically the fall of 1989 through the fall of 1993, creating the first UFC. And the book ends the day after UFC 1 with the after party, November 13th, 1993. I like to think of it as kind of like a three-act movie, beginning, middle, and end. So you can read this book now or you can read this in 100 years, but we wrote it to be timeless. So you can look back at this four-year period in the late 80s and early 90s and hear the real story of how this book came about. You can see the role that Horion Gracie played, Bob Meyerowitz from Semaphore Entertainment Group, Campbell McLaren, who likes to make a lot of boasts that he actually created it, and I think that's pretty much put to bed that he did not. John Milius, who directed Conan the Barbarian and was nominated for an Academy Award for writing Apocalypse Now. You see how all of these people played in, but all roads lead back to Art Davie, who cooked up this idea back in 1989.
Amazing stuff. And obviously, I mean, I've read some of the stories that have come out about it, you know, different interviews the guys have done. I thought one of the most interesting stories was how the name came about. It wasn't anybody you'd expect who came up with the name. It was a producer, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, from Semaphore Entertainment Group. You know, and Art talks about this, and he admits this freely in the book that, you know, he was an advertising guy, and one of his skill sets was to create names and products, and he drew a blank. He couldn't think of the name of his own company. And so one of the sales guys actually at Semaphore Entertainment Group said, how about Ultimate Fighting Championship? And I said, nah, I don't know. And he said, well, there's really nothing bigger than Ultimate. And Art thought, you know, I like that. I just didn't like the order, Ultimate Fighting Championship. But if you go back and you watch the early UFCs, it wasn't called the UFC at all. Nobody ever used it on the broadcast, referred to it. Actually, in researching the book and Art going through his archives, we found a travel brochure in Small World. The travel agent was Big John McCarthy's wife, Elaine, one of the nicest people in the world. And it was a travel brochure through Elaine McCarthy's travel agency, who was doing all the travel to Denver for the fighters and the VIPs and the fans. And Art wrote up the brochure. And not really thinking about it, he abbreviated the Ultimate Fighting Championship down to UFC. And that was the first use of the initials. We have the actual brochure, and we documented it in the book. But nobody really started calling it the UFC until about 1995. It was the Ultimate Fighting Championship, or unfortunately, as Bill Wallace said, twice open the original broadcast, the Ultimate Fighting Challenge.
As Harold Clarence Howard called it that too, Sean, if you remember that.
Absolutely, I do.
Oh, classic stuff. So great to talk to you, because I go back to UFC one days too, and my God, just what an evolution. What an exciting time that was. Wow.
You know what's crazy is that you can't put the toothpaste back in that tube. You're never,
right,
ever going to have a situation where somebody gets caught in a rear naked choke and they have no idea what they're doing, or you have someone like Pat Smith, who went on to become a good fighter, but, you know, had won the Sabaki Challenge, full contact karate, and says, I'm impervious to pain. And he gets caught in a heel hook, and all he can think to do is throw downward elbow strikes at Ken Shamrock's shin. You know, and then he taps to the heel hook. He was impervious to pain, I guess, excluding heel hooks. Or even if you look when Dan Severin comes in, easily takes down Hoist Gracie, he gets caught in a triangle. And Severin, it's not in the book. Our book's only on UFC 1, but, you know, from UFC 4, Severin freely admitted, you know, not only did I not know how to defend against the triangle, I didn't even know that I was in danger. I had no idea what was going on. But you know, a story that we document in the book is this legal, which I think really shows the mindset, is Art Jimerson. You know, Art Jimerson.
One glove.
In the story, which we lay out in the book. So Art Jimerson got a $17,000 guarantee. It was $50,000 to the winner, and there was escalating prize money. And I will say this, one thing in the book, we pull back the curtain. Anything you ever wanted to know, it's all there, and we have full documentation. How much did they earn? All of that. Two fighters got guarantees. Taylor Tooley, the sumo wrestler, got $6,000. Art Jimerson got $17,000. The rest was just travel and prize money.
Wow.
Losing alternates got $1,000. Lose in the first round was $1,500. All laid out in the book. But Art Jimerson, so $17,000, top 10 in the world as a pro boxer or cruiserweight. And on the check, right before the fight, Jimerson tells Art Davey, I didn't bring any gloves and I didn't bring any shoes, and you better get me both. So Art, about 4 hours before the start of UFC 1, sends his kid brother Matthew out to a sporting goods store in Arvada, Colorado, which is a suburb near Denver. Gets right off the store shelf a pair of black Nike high tops. Pull it up on YouTube. You can see the shoes right off the store shelf. And a pair of, like, boxing gloves, like that you would buy your 15-year-old kid. And then Jimerson takes them. And then somewhere between that time and walking out, he decides that he's only going to wear one glove. And
oh.
We documented pretty well in the book Art Davey's reaction when he sees Art Jimerson with one glove, knowing that this is going to be absolute clown stuff.
Oh,
and Art Jimerson taps to mount. But guys, to me, fighting Hoist Gracie with one glove is like showing up at Wimbledon with a baseball bat and saying, which court am I on? Where do I go?
And you remember, Sean, when the there was a debate about the rules, and the referees going over this, I think it was, I can't remember who the fighters were, maybe it was Shamrock and Smith, but it seemed like it went on for 2 minutes, and even Bill Wallace, or Jim Brown, no, Jim, was Jim Brown at one? No, he wasn't, I don't think, was he? But
no, Jim Brown was, absolutely, Jim Brown
okay.
was there.
Right, oh, okay, but I remember they were saying, what is this discussion about? We have two rules, okay? No biting, no eye gouging. I mean, it just went on and on for one of those fights. Oh, just what a circus. Wow.
Well, one of the best discoveries, I think, in the book is, and this was part of my job as the co-writer of this book, was to push Art Davey to remember in sequence and to find things. And Art found the actual rules and regulations document. He typed it up. Now, you've got to think, this is 1993. So he typed it up on the IBM Selectric 2 typewriter. I know there's a certain segment of the audience going, what's a typewriter? I'm sure I have two girls, 9 and 3. They would have no idea what a typewriter is. But he typed it up, and we actually reprint that in the book. And, you know, contrary to what was put out there, there are no rules. There are actually a decent amount of rules, and one of my favorite sections in the book is the rules meeting, where it almost breaks out to a full-scale brawl with Zane Frazier leading the way. Starts on, you know, can we tape the hands, tape the knuckles a quarter of an inch above, below? Can Shamrock wants to wear his Pancrase boots? Zane Frazier then wants to throw knees to the groin. Well, can we wear a cup? Can we wear a mouthpiece? And that was one of the fears of Art Davey, which we mentioned in Is This Legal in our book. You know, all mixed matches all before, whether they were shoots or works, Andre the Giant, Chuck Wepner was pretty obviously a work, but there were still a lot of stupid rules in it. Inoki versus Ali, I think that was a shoot, but there were a lot of stupid rules in that. Even going back to 1963, which we write about in the book, Judo Gene LaBelle versus the boxer Milo Savage, there were a lot of rules. And that was a big fear of Art Davey. Maybe the biggest was you get all these fighters together, not just from different planets, but, I mean, these guys are like from different universes coming in,
right,
and to get to agree to everything. That, to me, was the biggest accomplishment of Art Davey, creating the UFC,
yeah,
not inventing the sport of mixed martial arts, but getting all these different martial artists and combat sports participants to agree on one set of rules and one standard.
Yeah, because it had never been done before. That's the key. And nowadays, people just, it's almost like you had to be there in some ways. And I'm looking forward to reading this book. I'll be ordering it as soon as the show's over. But here's another thing I wanted to ask you. You can play spoiler with me on the book, but Art was interviewed once, and he talked about some of the responses that he got when he started putting out ads in Black Belt Magazine and Karate Kung Fu Illustrated, you know, for fighters. Now, does it talk about some of the bizarre responses that he got?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. That's one of my favorite sections, and this was so much fun as Art and I were writing this, because I was really pushing Art to remember, who did you contact? Who said no? I kind of love alternate histories. You know, Ernesto Hoost passed. Dan Gable, maybe the greatest wrestler in the history of the United States, would never return Art's phone call. Dennis Alexio, who was in Kickboxer, Jean-Claude Van Damme, said no immediately. Bart Vail said no and hung up the phone. Benny the Jetter Akita said, I have nothing to prove. These fighters are below me. I will not fight in this. It was amazing the fighters who could have been there. Leon Spinks, Mitch Blood Green, Randall Tex Cobb, Mark Gastineau, the New York Jet turned pro boxer. So many fighters said no. Art went to 38 different martial arts organizations in the U.S. and abroad and got no's or non-responses from all 38. Ultimately, how Art started to fill it up, and it's detailed in the book, is Art started placing ads. He bought ads in magazines like Inside Karate, Inside Kung Fu, Black Belt, and the responses started coming. That's how Art found the majority of the fighters answering ads. Trent Jenkins, who was an alternate, actually sent in a $100 check as an application fee, which in researching the book, we talked to Trent about that, and paid $100 and then got to be an alternate. But nobody would return Art's calls. Jim Coleman, who was the editor of Black Belt Magazine, said, this is dirty fighting, and he hung up the phone. What was amazing for me as such a hardcore of this fan, when Art and I wrote Is This Legal, guys, I knew that, like, the TV networks were against Art and the sponsors would be. I had no idea that the martial arts world would be against Art. But the reality, look, we all know this. There was a lot of fraud going on. You know, I just watched with my 9-year-old girl because she trains Muay Thai. We just watched Bloodsport from 1988. And I put out on Twitter, you know, this is what we all thought fighting was until Art Davey created the UFC. You know, it's almost this mystical superhuman stuff. And I think there were a lot of martial arts that knew, quite frankly, that they were going to be exposed. And that's why the no's kept coming. But it wasn't just the people outside of fighting were against Art Davey. It was everybody inside of fighting that was completely against Art Davey. They just wanted nothing to do with it.
Wow. Yeah, I heard that there were some guys that had, in fact, one guy, I guess, was posed in a river doing his Scottish. There were a lot of strange pictures and videos that came to Art, you know, with guys that wanted to compete. So that would have
been exactly right. That was the guy, and I don't know his name because it's after UFC 1. That was maybe UFC 2 or 3. But one of these I'm impervious to pain death touch guys, and he sends Art a photo. He's, like, posed in a freezing river in Alaska. And then when Art got a hold of him, the guy was like, yeah, I don't think I'm up for that. Yeah, I think I'll take a pass. I mean, but if you think about it, and it was so much fun watching Bloodsport again. I mean, I saw Bloodsport when I was a kid. It was 1988. I actually have a memory of seeing that in the movie theater. I think all of us who work in fighting have some memory of watching Bloodsport as a child. You know, it's just nonsense. It's just absolute nonsense. But that's what we believed fighting was. You're throwing spinning back kicks and nobody ducks or puts their hands up, you know. You can stand in a fighting style with your hands at your waist. Nobody shoots a takedown. You don't sprawl. And Art said, you know, it was the planets lining up. He could not have pulled it off without Horion Gracie. And there's so much credit given to Horion and the Gracie family. Horion needed Art, and Art needed Horion. And it was Art, when he was researching this back in 1989, he came across an article, and we quote from it a lot in the book, written in Playboy magazine by a man named Pat Jordan called Bad. And it was the first real mainstream exposure of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. But I remember as a kid, I mean, I had never even heard of Muay Thai, let alone Jiu-Jitsu or Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. So when you have someone like Art Jimmerson going up against Hoist Gracie, I mean, he may as well have been doing a magic trick because, you know, this stuff is just completely foreign to everybody.
Yeah, and I'm old enough to remember going back to the early 70s when the Kung Fu movies. In fact, I even paid money to go to a drive-in to see a few of them. I'll get that in public, you know, my God. But, you know, exactly. I mean, that was the traditional martial arts then were so just bottom line ineffective. And I do think you're absolutely right. There was a lot of fraud going on. A lot of these people were worried about being exposed, and no one knew the ground. I mean, the ground was another planet. And even today, I mean, I talked to a Kung Fu guy probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and I was talking to him about the ground. He says, well, our system is designed if the fight doesn't go to the ground. I said, well,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, and if it's 1978, maybe we'll all believe you and give you a big thumbs up. But,
exactly.
You know, and we go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, even in the early to mid-70s, when they started having some mixed matches between boxers, and they called it full contact karate back then.
Yep.
And the boxers would take about a round to figure these guys out. Then they'd start really laying into them. And the full contact guys, a lot of times, they would pull their punches because it was so deadly. They didn't want to kill anyone, and they wound up getting knocked out. And I think that kind of set the tone for some of this stuff later, too. They knew they'd be exposed.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. You know, and it's not just that you're humiliated. It's that this is business. So, you know, if you're running a school based on a certain martial art and then you go on national television pay-per-view and you look like a joke and you're pummeled and you're manhandled, that not only discredits you in your martial art, that kind of takes your students away. It hurts your business. It hurts your marketing. But, again, think about that. 38 martial arts organizations, and Art either got a flat-out no or no response from 38. And, honestly, had it not been for those ads that he purchased, I'm not sure that we would have had a UFC one. You know, Art
wow.
had to go out, and he had to get guys who were creative, who were thinking outside of the box. Horion Gracie was always going to put in a Gracie. We talk a lot about Art thought it was going to be Hickson, and it wound up being Hoyt. But, you know, these other guys were coming out of kickboxing, or in the case of Gerard Gourdeau, coming out of Muay Thai and Savate. But you didn't see these traditional guys. You know, where was the Kyokushin guy? Where was the Shotokan guy or the Aikido guy? The answer is they had no interest in showing up whatsoever. To me, even somebody like Dennis Alexio or Bart Vail, you know, who were supposed to be these big, tough guys, just, nope, hanging up the phone. Just not going to do it. Herb Perez, Olympic gold medalist from 1992, Art offered him $10,000. Flat out no from Taekwondo.
Mm-hmm. And from what I read about, from what I read about Art, he came up with this idea back in the 60s when he was in Thailand.
We fleshed this out, and is this legal? So Art was a Marine, was a medal recipient, fought in the Vietnam War, and Art had buddies, fellow Marines that he hung around with, and all were huge fight fans. And they would watch the different martial arts being in Vietnam. And one of Art's buddies took an R&R trip to Thailand, and he saw a mixed fight in a bar in Bangkok between a wrestler from India and a Muay Thai guy from Thailand. And the Muay Thai guy just chopped down the Indian wrestler with leg kicks. And
mm-hmm.
that fascinated Art. We also talk a book in the book, and, you know, I was proud of Art for putting this in because it's kind of an embarrassing story, but Art talks about being a fighter who was training for the Golden Gloves as a teenager, and he gets into a throwdown with this fellow teenager on the beach who had been a high school state runner-up. Art thought he was going to knock the guy out, and the guy shot a double leg and drilled Art, put him down and got on top of him and basically said, all right, what are you going to do now? And Art realized, I have no idea what I'm going to do now. So Art is a lifelong fight fan, started boxing as a little kid, always was interested in what would happen. Could this guy beat this guy? You know, they talked about it more as a Marine after they saw that mixed fight. You know, he was aware of Gene LaBelle versus Milo Savage in 1963, aware of Antonio Inoki versus Muhammad Ali in 1976. And where it really started when Art was an advertising executive, in October of 1989, he had Wisdom Imports as a client. One of Wisdom Imports' products was Tecate beer in the U.S. And Art pitched to Wisdom Imports, hey, as a way to sell Tecate in the U.S., let's see if we can't do some sort of mixed martial arts tournament. Tecate passed. Art wound up quitting his job, going all in, hooked up with Horion Gracie, became a student at the Gracie Academy, gets his blue belt. After 2 years of knowing Horion, finally convinces Horion to get involved with him. They form a partnership, and in 1993, they launched the UFC.
Wow. What a story.
Now, Sean, what would you say was the one thing that you enjoyed the most about this whole project?
Just working with Art. And I was talking to Sam Kaplan a couple of days ago, who's our former matchmaker at Bellator, who's a great friend of mine. I worked with Sam at M1 and obviously at Bellator. We were talking about Art, and I said, you know, Art's someone I speak to almost every day. I mean, outside of my family, I mean, he's one of my closest friends in the world. So the fact that we were friends before, we collaborated on this book, we had so much fun writing this book together, and we talk literally every single day, you know, not just about the book, just about our lives and the friendship. And, you know, I've told Art for a long time, even before we conceived of this book, I think the reason why he doesn't ever get his due is not just the person who created the UFC and found Horion Gracie and found Bob Myrowitz and Campbell McLaren and John Milius, is that he created something that was so simple. I mean, how did we not see this? Just throw in all these different fighters together, and we have one set where basically anything is allowed, and do it, you know, but everything had been regulated to death because the grapplers didn't want to strike and the strikers didn't want to grapple. So everything was, well, you can kick here, but you can't kick here. Well, you can go down, but you can't do this. Well, you can't do that submission. Well, you can't do this. Yeah, there's one of my favorite parts of the book, Art's interaction with Taylor Tooley, the sumo wrestler. And Taylor Tooley had a reputation as being a pretty tough street fighter back in his native Hawaii. Tooley, you know, who's 420 pounds, day before the first UFC, said, Mr. Davey, when I fight guys back in Hawaii, I usually just pick them up and throw them. Can I pick up these guys and throw them over the cage? And Art said, yeah, man, absolutely. If you can do it, go for it. And that was really his mindset, you know? Let's not worry about all this stuff. Let's throw it all in together and let's see who's best. And I think also in the book we really dispel this myth that this was set up for the Gracies to win. There's no doubt Horion Gracie wanted his kid brother to win. Art did not care. Art would have been just as happy if Art Jimerson had caught Hoist with a short little hook and knocked him unconscious, because Art knew he was creating a franchise. It wasn't just a one-night thing to put Gracie Jiu-Jitsu over. Art didn't get any money from Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, so there would have been no benefit to him doing that. And I'll say another thing, too. You know, there was kind of an alternate history for a while that the UFC was a one-night event, but we actually reprint in the book and quote from the original contract. The original contract was a five-year contract with 7-4 Entertainment Group, the pay-per-view provider. So Art knew what he was doing. This wasn't a one-off. This wasn't a one-shot. This was the start of what he hoped would be a franchise, and look where we are 20 and a half years later.
Yeah, it almost sounds like Art was a research scientist, just putting a bunch of stuff together in the laboratory and then doing an experiment and seeing how it's going to come out.
You know, and I think that was from being an advertising executive, because when you're an advertising executive, you've got to do research for your clients, and you've got to create the pitch, and you've got to think of different ideas and different angles and different strategies. So it's funny looking back how all of this came together, you know, and Art freely admits, he'll talk to you about it. We put it in the book. You know, he wouldn't have been able to do this without Horion Gracie, because he had absolutely no name whatsoever in the fighting world. He's this advertising guy from Los Angeles, California, from Carson, California. And what the Gracie name gave him was credibility. So even though people were like, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, they had no idea, at least he had his business partner, someone who was a black belt in a legitimate martial art. Even if they had never heard of the Gracies and never heard of that legitimate martial art, it wasn't just this advertising executive named Art Davey. So Art needed him, no question about it. Art needed Semaphore Entertainment Group, the pay-per-view provider, after he got no's from HBO and Showtime and ESPN. I love that we print those rejection letters in the book. It's so smug now to look back.
Even
Prime Ticket rejects Art with a form letter.
I just can't wait to read it. And something else, too, dawns on me, that I also do copywriting myself. And I know sometimes you have to try a promotion, and you have to split, maybe use a different slant, because we don't know what's going to work. We don't have any idea what's going to work, so you have to try it.
That's exactly right. You know, one thing Art and I talked about is how different the world of fighting would be if he hadn't read that Playboy article and found the Gracie family and found Horion. You know, I mean, what if he partnered with Dennis Alexio in this, or Herb Perez out of Taekwondo, you know? It's so different, because I can guarantee you, and you guys know this as well, everyone listening knows, if Art had partnered with someone out of a striking-based martial art or combat sport, they wouldn't have allowed all the ground stuff. But the Gracies had their backroom Gracie challenges, which were based on Brazilian Vale Tudo, which is my style against your style, and let's see what happens. And, you know, we'll put in some human decency, like no eye gouging, no groin shots, no biting. But in a lot of ways, and we acknowledge this in the book, you know, this is an outgrowth of not just ancient Pancration from the ancient BC Olympiad in ancient Greece, but this is an outgrowth of Vale Tudo in Brazil. With Vale Tudo, though, Vale Tudo was never a sport. It was a meeting place for two sports. It was a challenge, my style against your style, which is why Vale Tudo never took off. With
right.
with the UFC, obviously, it's a new sport being launched with mixed martial arts. You know, and there was stuff going on in Japan, and we talk a lot about that in the book. You know, and I'll leave it for everyone to decide what was going on in Japan with things like rings and shuto. Were those works? Were those shoots? But even if you say they were all shoots, and I'm here to tell you that there were a lot of works in there, but if you don't believe me and you still think that they were all shoots, there were a lot of restrictive rules. You know, you couldn't close a fist. You know, there were rope escapes. It wasn't mixed martial arts.
Yeah, when I first started training, I'm from Ohio, and I trained in a shoot fighting school back here, and independent strong style fight team. And at the time,
that's great. It's a fantastic gym. Fantastic gym.
Oh, okay. You've heard about it. Great. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is going back. I started back in 2002, and that's when Forrest Pettz and Jeff Cox were really starting to make their run, and Dan Bovich was around back then too, if you remember
mm-hmm.
that name.
Absolutely,
but,
I do.
My point is, Bart Vale, well, they were still affiliated with Bart Vale then. So I got to talk to him some about some of the early days there, too, you know, his fight with Mike Batonio. You know, that was rather, if you remember that one, from World Combat Championship.
Yep, I sure do.
Boy, that sure does. But, we had those rules, though. They would have, the reason I'm mentioning this is they'd have those rules about open hand, palm strikes and stuff like that, and then I got a few of Bart Vale's fights from over in Japan, and all I could say to people, read, you know, look at them, and then form your own conclusions.
go on YouTube and find Bart Vale versus Ken Shamrock, and,
right.
and yeah, let's talk about shoots and works.
Right. Yeah, and then just form your own conclusions. Yeah.
well, guys, so it's a thing in the book which I find fascinating. So there's a fighter named Scott Bisak who answers one of the ads. Who's a Lion's Den fighter, wants to fight in the first UFC, saw one of those ads in Inside Karate or Black Belt magazine. So as Art's talking to him, Scott winds up saying, you know, I just don't think I'm right for this, Mr. Davey. You want my instructor, the leader of the Lion's Den, Ken Shamrock? Gives him his number, Art calls, Ken Shamrock makes his pitch, asks him what he's doing. He talks about the fact that he's a professional wrestler in Japan. And Art said, well, is that real or fake? And Shamrock, when quoted in the book, said, well, it's mostly real. And Art said, look, you need to know this is all real. Art's convinced that Ken Shamrock, until the rules meeting the day before, thought that this was probably a strong style work, like it was going to be Japanese professional wrestling. That until he saw all the fighters in that room in the rules meeting and saw how volatile it was, that's when the little light bulb went off over Ken Shamrock's head. And Ken Shamrock had done shoots and works in Japan, and he'll freely admit it because he did professional wrestling. And then he realized, okay, this is the real deal. I need to turn up the gas on this one. And you saw what
yep.
he did to Pat Smith in the opening round, and no mercy
right.
on that heel hook.
Right.
Now, Sean,
that was Frank.
Obviously, Sean, you're part of the competition now, the UFC. So you probably have a little bit of a different slant on things. But how would you say... how would you rate how far they've come since Art came up with this concept?
Well, I'll tell you this, too. Is the Bellator commentator? I don't see the UFC as competition. I think it's MMA, man, you know. And maybe to me it's like college athletics where, you know, you can be a Big 12 guy. I live in Kansas City. I'm talking to you from my home in KC. You know, this is a Big 12 country out here, but... You know, you can be a fan of the Big 12 or a fan of the SEC or a fan of the Pac-12 or the ACC or the Big East, but you're a fan of college football or college basketball. So, to me, if the UFC does well, Bellator does well, World Series Fighting does well, ONE FC does well. You know, I'm big on supporting local MMA. I'll go with my 9-year-old girl. I know you get some looks, why are you there with a little girl? But I'll go with my 9-year-old girl around Kansas City. We'll go to pro and AMI shows. You know, I don't think that MMA should be in competition with each other. If the UFC gets 10 million people, I guarantee you our ratings on Bellator are going to go up. I hope
right.
we all do well. You know, guys, to me it's like saying that there's a set number of MMA fans in the world, and if we take one, then the UFC loses one, or if World Series of Fighting takes one, ONE FC loses one. I don't believe that. You know, I think we need to be going after the people who still watch boxing and won't give UFC a try, or maybe NFL fans or people who like action sports and extreme sports. I think there are so many people out there who, for whatever reason, have not given MMA a try. That's my view, and I know it's a minority voice in this sport, but yeah, I just, you know, if you ask me who's the competition for Bellator, I would say the next big boxing pay-per-view. That's who I think is our competition for Bellator. Oh, wait, I didn't answer your question. I went off on a rant. I didn't answer your question, so I'll answer your question. Look, the UFC has done phenomenally well. Art sold to Bob Meyerowitz, who was the head of the pay-per-view company, after UFC 5, made a little over $1 million. You know, Bob Meyerowitz ran it into the ground, stripped it of its assets. He lost TV. The dark days of the UFC, which sometimes get unfairly blamed to Art Davey. Art was gone, man. He sold after UFC 5. That was all Bob Meyerowitz. And had the Fertittas and Dana White not come along, there might be MMA in this country. There probably would be, but there wouldn't be a UFC because Bob Meyerowitz ran it into the ground and took all of its value out of it, no question about it. You know, I think what Zuff has done is fantastic. The fact they got a $700 million deal from Fox, and I think the success of what Art Davey started and what the Zuffa guys have done, I think that's led to the fact that, you know, we have Bellator on spike and that MMA is maybe the fastest-growing sport in the world. Certainly it is in the U.S. and Canada. So all credit to the UFC. I mean, I'm just not one who's going to pick sides. You know, I just don't understand the mentality of, well, you can only be a fan of one promotion. You know, I don't get it. You can have your favorite fighters and your favorite shows, but, you know, I always tell people, be a fan of the sport. I won't try to convince anybody who doesn't like MMA to like MMA, you know, different taste. What I would say to people, if you're a fan of MMA, then be a fan of MMA. Don't just be a fan of a promotion.
Hi.
And looking at Scott Coker coming in now at Bellator, can you give us a little bit of a State of the Union report on how it's going and what's coming up for the season?
Yeah, first off, I think the world of Scott Coker, and who doesn't? I mean, what an amazing guy. Look what he did for the sport. And to be an MMA and to have no enemies that I can find and to find no one says anything bad about you, you know, I aspire to that, and I hope that's the case with me, but it's certainly the case with Scott Coker. And the way that he's come in, he's just such a classy person. I knew him a little bit when I was the M1 commentator with Jimmy, and we did a couple of M1 Strikeforce co-promotes. But I didn't know Scott Coker that well. But he's just made such a big impression on me with everyone in Bellator. You know, I initially liked the tournament idea, and I bought into it. But I saw very quickly, and to his credit, Jimmy Smith saw it quicker than I did. You know, you can't sustain the tournament formats. And look, it got very confusing. My buddy Jerry Millen, who hired me at Pride and took me to M1, would say all the time, you know, Shawnee, I have a tough time keeping up. You know, you have like 7-8 tournaments, and this tournament's in the quarterfinals, and this one's in the finals. It got to be very, very confusing. And, I looked to Pride. Pride had the one-off fights all the time, but they would do their big Grand Prix. And when they did their big Grand Prix, it was special. I mean, some of the best moments in the history of the sport, like when Mark Coleman beat Igor Volchanchin, right? Or when Mirko Krokop threw that head kick and knocked out Wanderlei Silva. Those were all part of their tournaments, their Grand Prix. So I think there's a place in this sport for those big tournaments. But when you're just locked in rigidly, like we were with Bellator before Scott Coker to the tournaments, I think it's a losing game. And also, ultimately, people want to see the best two fighters go at it. You know, and just take the Michael Chandler situation, all right? So if we keep with the same tournaments, if Scott Coker doesn't come in theory now, and I don't know anything about contracts, I'm just saying in theory, Mike Chandler coming off of two heartbreaking split decision losses that a lot of people still debate that he won on both of them, he goes into the tournament. Let's say he goes in the quarterfinals, and let's say he loses another split decision. Then what? I mean, when does he get to fight Will Brooks? You know, people want to see the best fights being made. That's why I think tournaments in the long term, they just don't work. So with Scott Coker, that we're moving away from tournaments, it goes to straight matchmaking, which has always worked in MMA. It's always worked in boxing. Look, Art Davey saw that. He knew after Gracie Shamrock won, don't wait for the tournament to play out. Let's not try to rig anything or artificially manipulate a tournament. Let's just make it as a super fight. And lo and behold, you have Gracie versus Shamrock 2. You know, Art Davey knew immediately, hey, we can have our tournaments, but ultimately you have to do matchmaking because people want to see the two best and the two hottest fighters compete against each other.
Well, we just got our 60-second warning. Do you have any closing statements, or can you tell people where to find this book and where to find you online?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. So, and I'll tell people honestly, you can find it at Barnes & Noble across the U.S., but save your money. Go online right now to Amazon. You'll get a better price. You can buy it in a hardcover, or you can download it right now as a Kindle. I think the Kindle is under $10, and the hardcover on Amazon is under $20. The book is called Is This Legal? The Inside Story of the First UFC by Art Davey with me, Sean Wheelock. You can also get me on Twitter. I'm extremely responsive, if anybody who follows me can attest to, at Sean Wheelock. And again, Is This Legal? Right now, as I just checked it on Amazon, as I have a tendency to do obsessively, we're number one in our category right now in martial arts. And I just
Great.
Want people to just keep reading it, enjoying the book, and I want it to spread throughout the MMA community. I wrote it for everybody, but I especially wrote it for MMA fans.
Awesome. Well, it's been great chatting with you. I wish we had a little bit more time, but maybe we'll revisit this down the line. Maybe further into the Bellator season, you can come on and give us another State of the Union. And we'll chat again. But awesome.
Guys,
it was
great questions. It was really my pleasure. Thank you. I'm happy to be back anytime.
That's great, cool. Sean.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. Good night.
Thank you.
And we will keep plugging the book for you. So that's all we have for tonight, folks. Thanks for stopping by and listening. And we'll try to get another great guest for next week. And like Sean said, go out on Amazon, grab the book, and read a great story like you've been telling us some snippets of. It sounds like a great read, so check it out. Thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you next week.